Happens in Idaho is a podcast following the trial of Lori Vallow Daybell. This podcast is hosted and produced by me, Kayla Waters, in correlation with my other podcast, True Crime Exposed. I have followed this case closely as it all came to an end here in Idaho, just 30 minutes north of where I grew up and currently live. I will be attending most days of Lori Daybell's trial at the Madison County Courthouse in Rexburg, Idaho. This is the area which the crimes took place, and this is the only location outside of Ada County that has access to the live stream of this trial. Each day, I will recap the trial for you here. Welcome to It Ends in Idaho, the Lori Daybell Trial. Now the state calls Deputy Coulter Cannon with the Fremont County Sheriff's Office. Tanya Rawlings will question this witness. On October 9th, 2019, Deputy Cannon was working a 12-hour shift when he is called to the Daybell home at 202 North, 1900 East. There's been a reported threat. He's informed that a kid pointed a paintball gun at the woman living there at the Daybell home. Joseph Murray, Tammy's son-in-law, had helped her call dispatch. Deputy Cannon arrived at the scene 6 to 7 minutes later. Deputy Cannon testifies that he was told the man was wearing all black and a ski mask as he approached Tammy Daybell. He recalls that Chad and Garth appeared calm, while Tammy was just a little nervous. The deputy did not go across the street to investigate because lights were off and he did not want to wake anyone up. He also states that Tammy was pretty convinced that what she saw was a paintball gun. Deputy Cannon did not find any indication of actual bullets or paintballs being shot at the scene when he later conducts a walkthrough. Tammy's son-in-law had heard her scream from across the street. This incident occurs around 9 p.m. Tanya Rawlings has no further questions once Deputy Cannon confirms that his search of the property a couple weeks later did not turn up any bullets, bullet holes, or paint. Jim Archibald will conduct the cross-examination. He has Deputy Cannon restate that no physical evidence of something happening on the 9th of October was found. He then says that police waited 3 months until they finally took metal detectors out to the property on January 3rd, 2020. The deputy testifies that this is correct. Nothing was found. Jim Archibald has no further questions, and the prosecution calls Deputy Helena Kayakumanu. Helena has worked as a supervisor of dispatch for 2.5 years. She now works for the Fremont County Sheriff's Office, but she previously worked as the 911 dispatcher. Tanya Rawlings is conducting this direct examination. The calls to 911 made on October 9th, 2019 were recorded, and Ms. Rawlings asks to have these admitted as evidence. The first call comes in from Joseph Murray, Tammy's son-in-law. Deputy Kayakumanu testifies that she did not personally know Tammy Daybell. She just knew that Tammy was the librarian at her children's school. The second 911 call is also played. This call was made by Tammy Daybell. I think it was the first time I ever heard Tammy Daybell's voice. It makes me sick what happened to her. She did not deserve this from the man she loved for 3 decades.
October 9, 2019, 21 hours, 49 minutes, 20 seconds.
Fremont County Sheriff's Office. Hi, I need to report something. Okay, go ahead. What's the address? Okay, 202 North, 1900 East.
Rawlings has no further questions, and Jim Archibald has no questions. Deputy Helena Kayakumanu is released from her subpoena and led off the witness stand. Christina West is called next by Lindsay Blake. Christina was a dispatcher for the Fremont County Sheriff's Office in October of 2019. She was working on October 19th when she received a call about a deceased individual named Tammy Daybell. The state moves to admit this 911 call. Following the playing of this audio, Lindsay Blake has no further questions. Jim Archibald does cross-examine this witness. Jim says, "So someone who identifies himself as Chad Daybell asks for an ambulance or a coroner?" Christina testifies that she thinks he just asked for a coroner. She then goes back on that and says, No, wait. I don't believe he asked for anything. He said his house was on the corner. He did not ask for an ambulance or a coroner. Christina says that she sent out the deputies. From there, the police would then make the determination on whether or not to send the coroner or the ambulance. Lindsay Blake stands to conduct redirect when Jim Archibald concludes, and Lindsay asks if Chad indicated that Tammy was clearly dead, stiff and cold. Christina testifies yes, and then Miss Blake asks if that information is relayed over radio traffic to a deputy. Christina says yes, but her deputy was already in the dispatch office, so it was verbally relayed to her. From there, the deputy could determine whether or not to call out a coroner. Lindsay says that there was no indication in that call that life-saving measures were being requested. Christina West testifies exactly. That's why I did not dispatch out an ambulance. Miss Blake has no further questions, and Christina is released from her subpoena and excused from the witness stand. Now Judge Boyce calls for a morning recess. By about 10:20 a.m., court is back in session, and the prosecution calls Alyssa Greenhall. She's an officer with the Rexburg Police Department now, but she used to work for the Fremont County Sheriff's Office. Officer Greenhall testifies that she was dispatched to the scene that morning of October 19th, 2019. She says that it's typical in an unattended death to look for signs of foul play. She didn't see any. When she arrives, Chad leads her to Tammy's body and indicates that he had moved her body from where he found her. Chad claims to the officer that he woke up with Tammy in the middle of the night. She was coughing and throwing up. Tammy had fallen out of the bed, but her legs and feet were caught up in the sheets, while her upper body had rolled out of the bed and her head landed on the floor of the bedroom. Chad told the officer that his son Garth helped move Tammy back into their bed and he covered her with the blankets. Chad had claimed that Tammy fell in the driveway about a month earlier and that she refused to go to the doctor's office. He would tell Officer Greenhall that Tammy suffered from high blood pressure. The officer testifies that Tammy's son Garth never contradicted his father, Chad. Lindsay Blake asks to admit photographic evidence. The defense objects, saying that the pictures are graphic in nature. Judge Boyce allows the photos to be admitted and viewed by the jury and the courtroom. Officer Greenhall testifies that the first picture is taken from the entryway of Tammy's bedroom. Tammy is lying on the bed. The officer did not move Tammy, but when the other officers arrive, they do to assess her. A picture is shown of pink foam seeping from Tammy's mouth. Officer Greenhall testifies that a pink reddish foam ran from Tammy's mouth down her cheek. Lindsay asks if the officer had ever witnessed this before, and she says no. The prosecution then asks if Officer Greenhall had ever responded to an asphyxiation death, and she testified, not that she knows of. She goes on to say that she did notice lividity on Tammy's back and legs. She also noticed a small bruise on Tammy Daybell's arm. Officer Greenhall accompanied Tammy's body to the coroner's office. Now Lindsay Blake shows State Exhibit 295. By the time this photo was taken, the pink substance had been removed from Tammy's mouth. Lindsay Blake has no further questions. Jim Archibald conducts cross-examination. Officer Greenhall states that she is dispatched to the scene around 6 a.m. She testifies that she did not ask Chad Daybell about the 20-minute delay in calling 911 after he claims he heard her fall out of bed around 5:40 or 5:45 a.m. Jim asks, "Bodies don't move if they aren't already deceased, right?" And the officer testifies, "Yes." And Jim says, "Then Tammy would have been alive when she fell out of the bed." And Officer Greenhall says, "I assume so." Jim then asks if she believes Tammy then died between the time she fell out of the bed and the time that the officer arrives on the scene. Officer Greenhall says that she is not qualified to make that determination. She goes on to testify that to her knowledge, no CPR was performed. Jim states that he has no further questions. Lindsay stands for redirect, and she asks Officer Greenhall if it appeared that Tammy had only been dead for around 20 minutes, and the officer says no. It appeared she had already been dead longer than that. Lindsay asks when she believes Tammy had died, but Jim Archibald objects based on the witness not being qualified. And Judge Boyce sustains this objection, citing speculation. So Lindsay asks if Tammy was cold to the touch when Officer Greenhall arrived, and if there were signs of lividity. The officer testifies yes to both of these questions. Lindsay has no further questions, and Officer Alyssa Greenhall is officially released from her subpoena. Lindsay Blake also calls the next witness, Cammie Wilmore. In 2019, she was the deputy coroner in Fremont County. Cammie worked as a medical assistant for 40 years. She would go on calls when the coroner was out of town or if she was closer to the scene. When Cammie responds to Tammy Daybell's unattended death, she testifies that she was fairly new, so she had only gone on 5 unattended deaths on her own outside of training. She had never been to a scene where the death was determined to be caused by asphyxiation. Chad told Cammie a similar story to what he told Officer Allie Greenhall. Cammie felt that Chad was distraught. Garth Daybell was not in the room when she arrived. Cammie thought it looks like Tammy had been dead for at least a few hours. Chad mentions that his wife was going through menopause and liked to sleep with her leg out of the bed. He thought he tossed around a bit in his sleep, and he must have nudged her off. Cammie does say that it was an unusual death because Tammy was only 49 years old. She was looking for marks on Tammy's neck, like scratches, but she didn't see anything. There were bruises in Tammy's forearms, but they did not look fresh. Cammy testifies that quite a bit of foam was coming from Tammy's mouth when she first walked into the room, and this struck her. She assumed that maybe this had been caused by heart failure due to the pinkish color of the foam. Cammy had never seen that before at a death scene. This caused her concern, and Cammy even looked up poisoning. Tammy was cold, and rigor mortis had started to set in. This is the stiffness of the body post-mortem. When you first pass away, your body is limp. Over a period of time, the body will turn stiff. Cammy testifies she believes Tammy would have been dead before 5:30 a.m. The coroner, Brenda Dye, arrives on the scene shortly after Cammy, and she takes over the examination. Chad Daybell had informed Cammy and Brenda that he did not want an autopsy done for his wife. Cammy had concerns about Tammy's death due to the pink foam and Tammy's age. Lindsay ends her questioning by asking Cammy Wilmore if at the time of Tammy's death, she had heard of the names Tylee Ryan, JJ Vallow, Lori Vallow, or Alex Cox. Cammy says no. Jim Archibald has no questions, so Cammy is excused from the witness stand. Next, Lindsay Blake calls Fremont County Coroner Brenda Dye. Brenda testifies that, like Cammy, she thought Chad seemed distraught. Nothing had caused her concern. Chad and Garth had told Brenda a similar story about how they moved Tammy's body back onto the bed after Chad called for his son Garth to come help. Chad repeats the same statements he told Officer Greenhall and Cammy Wilmore. Brenda testifies that she had actually seen sputum before. This is what she called the foam coming from Tammy's mouth. Brenda said she noticed the blood-stained sputum, but she was not alarmed. Brenda had responded to about 20 unattended deaths before Tammy's, and she had never been involved in one that was deemed to have been caused by asphyxiation. Lindsay Blake asks Brenda if she notices anything about a photograph of the bed Tammy was found on. It's shown to the jury and to Brenda. She testifies that she sees it's a little bit off the box springs. Both Cammy and Brenda testified that there were no injuries indicating that Tammy had hit her head on a nightstand. Brenda testifies that she did ask Chad how Tammy could have fallen out of bed if she was deceased. Chad claimed it was because he moved around in the night, and Tammy's legs must have been caught in the sheets as she was somehow nudged partly off the bed. Brenda testifies that rigor mortis tends to set in about 2 to 6 hours after passing away. She estimates that Tammy died between 12:30 a.m. and 2 a.m. based on the rigor mortis and the lividity in her body where the blood had pooled on her back and the backs of her legs. She also took Tammy's body temperature and noticed that her abdomen was cold to the touch, which is the last place to lose its warmth. Brenda signed off on Tamara Daybell's death certificate for the cause of death. She determined it was pulmonary edema due to syncopal episodes with seizure-like activity, and the manner of death was deemed natural. Lindsay Blake asks if that decision was based in large part on what Chad Daybell had told her. Brenda testifies yes, as well as Tammy's daughter, who gave Brenda a medical history background on Tammy. Brenda testifies that she attended the exhumation and autopsy. A medical examiner conducted this autopsy at the morgue in Utah. At this time, a second break is taken. Remember, court on this date is concluding at 1:30 p.m., so they don't allow a full lunch, but we break for about 40 minutes. Following this recess, Brenda Dye is back on the stand. Lindsay wants to back up just a little bit, asking if Brenda brought up syncopal episodes or if that was Chad. She testifies that it was Chad, mentioning that Tammy had multiple fainting episodes. Brenda says the medical term for fainting is a syncopal episode. Brenda goes on to testify that the medical examiner was able to do a much more extensive exam of Tammy's body than she was able to do at the scene. Lindsay asks if the medical examiner also had more information from outside sources than Brenda did at the time she observed Tammy. And Miss Dye testifies yes. Brenda says that the medical examiner determined the cause of death for Tammy Daybell is asphyxiation/suffocation. The manner of death is homicide. Lindsay Blake asks, "Do you have any reason to refute the medical examiner's findings?" And Brenda says, "No." She also testifies that she had never heard of Lori Vallow, Tylee Ryan, JJ Vallow, or Alex Cox before she observed Tammy's body on October 19, 2019. Lindsay asks if Brenda intends to modify Tamara Daybell's death certificate after attending the autopsy and learning information from the medical examiner. She testifies yes. She intends to make a change to the death certificate, citing that the cause of death was asphyxiation, suffocation, and that the manner of death was homicide. The prosecution has no further questions. Now Jim starts his questioning by asking if Brenda has already changed Tammy Daybell's death certificate, but she says no due to the pending investigation. Jim asks what the trial is going to change about the death certificate. Are you waiting to see if it's true? Brenda says no, it will be changed. She also testifies that Tammy's daughter Emma was adamant alongside Chad that she did not want her mom to have an autopsy. Emma was against it. She thought it was too extensive to be done for her mom. Garth Daybell was at the scene, but he did not have an opinion on the autopsy. Jim says, quote, "Chad Daybell convinced you and your deputy and the officer that nothing bad happened." Brenda replies, "Concluding our investigation, that's what we ultimately decided." Jim Archibald concludes his questioning. Brenda Dye is released from her subpoena, and she is led off the witness stand. Next up, the state calls Spencer Cook, the technology director at Sugar Salem School District. In April of 2021, Fremont County detectives reach out to Spencer, asking him to aid them in checking Tammy Daybell's email. Tammy was the librarian at the elementary school and the computer lab teacher in the Sugar Salem district. Spencer says Tammy was active on her email, and the one she received from Charles Vallow that we heard about in earlier testimony was in Tammy's delete folder. Even in the summer months, Tammy was active on her email, and as the computer teacher, she was obviously very literate in this technology. Spencer found this email in the archive system under Tammy Daybell's account. It was no longer in her inbox, instead being moved to that delete folder. The email was sent from Charles Vallow to Tammy Daybell on June 29, 2019. This was the one and only email Charles Vallow had sent to Tammy's work email. This is the email where Charles states Lori and Chad are having an affair. Spencer also found on Tammy's account that she had only one email account blocked, and that email belonged to Charles Vallow. Tanya Rawlings has no further questions, and the defense will not conduct cross-examination. Spencer Rammel now calls Kelsey Harris, a clogging instructor. Tammy took Kelsey's class in Sugar City, and the two women also worked together at the school. Kelsey worked in the kitchen, and Tammy was the librarian. Tammy started the clogging classes by the end of August 2019 or the beginning of September 2019, all the way until she died in October of 2019. The classes were an hour long, and Kelsey says that Tammy never fell behind due to exhaustion. Kelsey and Tammy would also attend a high fitness class together. This was done in 2019, and this group fitness class is high intensity. Kelsey never noticed anything wrong with Tammy Daybell. She says that Tammy was fit and in good health. Spencer Rammel has no further questions, and the defense will not ask any questions, so Kelsey Harris is excused as a witness. Tanya Rawlings will conduct the direct examination of the next witness, Shanna Miller. She also worked in the Sugar Salem School District. Shanna was a part of the committee that hired Tammy as the school's computer specialist and the librarian. Twice a week, Shanna would take a high fitness class with Tammy and her daughter, Emma. She says Tammy looked healthy, in shape, and happy. They had done these classes together for about a year by the time Tammy died. Shanna saw Tammy at the school the day before Tammy was killed. That day prior, Tammy was working the school lunch count. She testifies that Tammy was as happy and jovial as always. She smiled at all the kids and freely handed out compliments. Shanna says that Tammy hadn't complained about feeling sick. Shanna observed that there was going to be no funeral. The people in the school and the community wanted to honor Tammy. Jim Archibald objects that this is hearsay, and Judge Boyce sustains. Shanna goes on to say that the school principal put together a memorial service for Tammy so that the people in Rexburg could honor her. The prosecution has no further questions, and the defense has no questions. With that, Shanna Miller is released from her subpoena and led off the witness stand. Just before 1 p.m., court is adjourned for the day. Witness testimony will be back underway at 8:30 a.m. on Monday. The fourth week of witness testimony for the prosecution begins on May 1st, 2023. Rob Wood first calls Keely Coleman, a senior DNA analyst at Bodhi Technology. Rob starts by having Keely answer a lot of questions about DNA and DNA technology. She testifies that in May of 2022, she received three different DNA profiles of Lori Vallow, Tylee Ryan, and Melanie Gibb. She was also sent a piece of hair that was attached to the duct tape that encased a black garbage sack around J.J. Vallow's body. A portion of the hair was put into a test tube and put through multiple washes to get rid of any extraneous DNA. Keely testifies that additional samples were added to the samples and then put through a heating and cooling step. That isolated any DNA that may have been present. They locate the DNA that was present and then made lots and lots of copies. From this hair sample, a partial female DNA profile was obtained. Tylee Ryan and Melanie Gibb were excluded. The DNA matched the DNA that had been provided for Lori Vallow. She says the probability of randomly selecting an unrelated individual with that partial DNA profile is 1 in 71 billion. Keely says that an administrative review is done to ensure that another qualified analyst agrees with your findings. The analyst reviewing Keely's findings did agree with the results. John Thomas conducts the cross-examination. It's not a shock that John hammers her about her education and her work experience. Keely explains that if you want a sample to go to the FBI database, they require you to type SGR locations. Different labs use different kits. Some use kits with 20, some with 23, and some with 24. Each kit is slightly different, and you're required to test the 20, but they're all a little different. She uses the example of cake, saying one might be a Ghirardelli and one might be a Duncan Hines. She states, quote, "In the end, you're getting a DNA profile, but some of the ingredients may be a little different." She says that's how you can think of those SGR locations. You're required to test the 20, but in this case, they tested 24. John gets Keely into some very detailed DNA talk, where she is describing different alleles, what they mean, or they could be missing, how they could be present, and honestly, I barely understand what she's saying. So I'll leave you to listen to her testimony in a whole if you're interested. She is far too smart for me. Keeley testifies that for Brody's level of comparison, they are required to have 3 full loci out of the 20 that the FBI requires. John has a chart published detailing the 22 alleles tested on the hair. Keeley testifies that out of the 22, there are 13 that showed no result. And John says that's a lot. Keeley says there are a range of the numbers of alleles that can be obtained. Basically, Keeley's testimony shows that Lori Vallow's hair was attached to the duct tape found on the garbage sacks on JJ Vallow's body. That hair, Lori's own hair, was covered in her son's body decomposition. Lindsay Blake now calls Rick Wright to the stand. He was a special agent with the FBI for 24 years. Later, he became a contract special investigator. Wright worked as the Violent Crimes Against Children coordinator in Denver from 2007 to 2018. In 2018, Agent Wright moves to Salt Lake City for the field office in Utah. The Rexburg Police Department had contacted Agent Wright on November 27, 2019. They did this because there is the Federal Kidnapping Act, deeming that the FBI could get involved because the case involved a missing child under the age of 12. Rick Wright becomes the case agent for the FBI. Ian Pawlowski came forward to Agent Wright and agreed to record conversations he had with his wife, Melanie Pawlowski, and her aunt, Lori Vallow. The things Ian had told him made Agent Wright worry about the safety of the children. When the FBI was contacted in late November, it was only clear to police that JJ was missing. Soon, the FBI found out that JJ's sister, Tylee Ryan, was also unable to be located. Agent Wright worked alongside Nick Balance, who we heard from in earlier episodes. The agent had Nick turn over all his cell phone pings and location data collected from September of 2019. Nick ultimately shares September and October 2019 with Agent Wright. The device associated with Alex Cox seemed to make the move to Rexburg, Idaho on September 1st, 2019. The device then pings in Yellowstone National Park on September 8th. A photograph of Tylee, JJ, and Alex is taken on this date outside of Old Faithful at Yellowstone at 3:49 p.m. This is the last known photograph of Tylee Ryan. Multiple data points from each device connected to the suspects in this case are retrieved from GPS, Wi-Fi, and cell tower data. Agent Wright says that the GPS was the most reliable and accurate. After leaving the park, Alex's device does not stop for a long period of time on his drive home, until he stops in the town of West Yellowstone at Buffalo Bill's Barbecue Grill. This is a place where we eat almost every time we are in Island Park. West Yellowstone is just north of this area. Isn't it weird to think that we probably run into evil people way more than we think? Just going about our day-to-day tasks, that's a thought that keeps me up at night. On September 8th, 2019, the vehicle Alex is driving returns to Lori Vallow's apartment by 8:37 p.m. Alex has a device that heads from Lori's apartment down to the gas station at 9:43 p.m. The device returns to Lori's apartment and then back to Alex's apartment. Agent Wright has confidence that Tylee Ryan returned to this apartment complex where Lori and Alex lived in separate apartments at that same complex located at 565 Pioneer Road. To him, this was Tylee's last known location as they conducted their investigation. During the early morning hours of September 9th, 2019, these data points ping at Lori's home between 2:42 a.m. and 8:49 a.m. A device connected to Alex is all over Lori's home. Agent Wright reviews the location data from the device of Alex Cox for all of September. He would often be at Lori's apartment, 175, in the evening hours, but he would always return to his apartment, 107, by midnight. September 9th was the only date that Agent Wright observed the device travel into Lori Vallow's home between the hours of midnight and 6 a.m. Later that morning, Alex is tied to a device that leaves the home at 9 a.m. and travels to Chad Daybell's property. The device arrives by 9:15 a.m. Alex has a device that pings multiple data points on Chad Daybell's property that morning until 9:45 a.m. Only a few were high-quality data. One of these high-quality data points shows the device of Alex Cox near the shed on Chad Daybell's property at 9:21 a.m. This is a GPS data hit. At 9:22, another data point is shown by a gate near the side driveway of the property. At 9:39, there is another GPS data point putting the device of Alex Cox at the Daybell residence, and another at 10:57 a.m. Agent Wright testifies that the text Chad sent to Tammy Daybell that morning about burying a raccoon and burning tree limbs, mixed with the data points located at the fire pit in the pet cemetery of the Daybell property, set off many red flags for investigators. The remains of Tylee Ryan were found near the data points obtained from the device in this case on the date of September 9, 2019. Agent Wright testifies that on the last day JJ is seen alive, the device belonging to Alex Cox travels between Lori Vallow's apartment and his own apartment multiple times from 4:29 p.m. till 12:11 a.m. His device then stays at his apartment from just after midnight until 9:41 a.m. At that time, the device heads north towards Chad Daybell's home, arriving at 9:55 a.m. The device is only there for 17 minutes before it leaves the property and travels back to Lori Vallow's apartment, arriving at 10:22 a.m. The device remains in this apartment until 11:14 a.m. At 9:55 a.m. and 10:02 a.m., the data points place Alex Cox at the pond on Chad Daybell's property. JJ's remains were buried near this pond. His device pings at Chad Daybell's property four times in September on the 6th, the 9th, the 23rd, and the 25th. Two receipts were found inside the Jeep Wrangler seized in the investigation into the attempted shooting of Brandon Boudreau. One receipt was from October 1st, 2019 at 1:12 p.m. at a Mexican restaurant in Gilbert, Arizona. Odd because Brandon Boudreau is shot at the next day on October 2nd, 2019 at his home in Gilbert, Arizona. The second receipt recovered is dated for October 18th, 2018 at 8:05 p.m. This is from Chick-fil-A in Ammon, Idaho. Tammy Daybell dies the next morning on October 19, 2019. Alex purchases a burner phone with cash from Walmart in Rexburg on September 25th. His other device placed him at this location, and the burner phones were recovered when Alex left two of them behind when they all abandoned the apartments in Rexburg, Idaho. Data points from the device of Alex Cox place him at the Sportsman's Gun Club in Rexburg, Idaho. We heard about this location in earlier testimony. A device tied to Alex visits multiple gun ranges on October 7th and October 8th, 2019. Tammy was shot at on October 9th, 2019. On October 12th, 13th, and 15th, the device of Alex Cox visits more gun ranges. October 15th is the last day Alex's device visits a gun range. The gun range data is significant because the attempted shootings of Brandon Boudreau and Tammy Daybell. As for the cell phone that Alex purchased on September 8th, 2018, Chad and Alex texted on it 10 times the following day, on October 9th, 2019, the day that Tammy is shot at. A lunch break is called during Agent Wright's testimony, and he's back on the stand following this break. He testifies that after Alex leaves Chick-fil-A on October 18th around 9:32 p.m., his device drives to a church near Chad Daybell's property. The device is at the Salem Church, 2.5 miles down the road from Chad Daybell's home. It sits here from 10:07 p.m. till 10:45 p.m. Between 10:45 p.m. and 11:53 p.m., there is no data for the device tied to Alex. The next data point is shown at 11:53 p.m. driving south on the highway. The device doesn't return to Alex's apartment. Instead, it heads to Idaho Falls and stops at the Hilton Garden Inn for the night. This is where I had my wedding reception, and I would like Alex Cox to stop ruining everything. The three dates in October that Alex was at Chad Daybell's property were October 9th, 15th, and 18th. John Thomas will conduct the cross-examination. He starts by asking about education and work experience. And he goes on to ask Agent Wright if the 17 minutes Alex spent at Chad's property on September 23, 2019 was enough time to dig a grave and bury a body. Based on what Agent Wright saw at the scene, he thinks the disposal of JJ Vallow's body would have taken much longer than that. On the redirect conducted by Lindsay Blake, she asks Agent Wright if the 17 minutes is long enough for multiple people to dispose of a body. Agent Wright testifies that the location data is only the time that a device belonging to Alex Cox is placed there. It doesn't attribute to the time it took someone to dig a gravesite. With that, the prosecution has no further questions. And that concludes Agent Rick Wright's testimony. Next, Lindsay Blake calls Dr. Eric Christensen, the chief medical examiner for the state of Utah. He executed Tammy Daybell's autopsy following the exhumation of her body. His office was contacted in November of 2019 by the Fremont County Sheriff's Office. They were requesting aid in exhuming Tamara Daybell's body. Dr. Christensen obtained medical records for Tammy Daybell before he did the autopsy. He testifies that Tammy Daybell's cause of death was asphyxiation and her manner of death was homicide. He explains that asphyxiation is the process in which a person is deprived of air. They're unable to take in an adequate amount of oxygen to continue living. There were no external injuries or obvious injuries that were the cause of Tammy's death. Dr. Christensen explains that asphyxiation is a diagnosis of exclusion. It requires that you evaluate other causes of death and rule them out. This autopsy contained no natural disease and no injuries that would have caused death. He goes on to say that the bruises on Tammy happened within the hours surrounding her death. The bruises are consistent with someone being restrained, and that is also consistent with asphyxia being the cause of death. Tammy's medical records and body during autopsy did not indicate she had heart or seizure problems. No drugs or poisons were found in Tammy Daybell's property. Dr. Christensen says they even did further testing of toxicology on Tammy than they would normally do in other cases. But everything came back negative, except the medication she was prescribed. An afternoon break is called during the doctor's testimony, and when he's back on the stand, Lindsay Blake asks if Tammy's organs appeared normal. Dr. Christensen testifies that they somewhat did, but the lungs were filled with fluid, and a dry, frothy foam was in her throat. A photograph of Tammy's face is published. The pink foam can be seen around her mouth. Dr. Christensen testifies that this pink foam is due to pulmonary edema. He said they see this often in drowning death, opioid addiction, heart failure, and many other things. This was a part of his ruling, that the cause of death was asphyxiation. He says that whatever caused the pulmonary edema would be the cause of death. It is a result of the cause of death. It is a physical manifestation of other problems. Dr. Christensen marks on an exhibit to indicate where the bruises on Tammy Daybell were located. He marks three bruises on Tammy's upper right arm, one on her chest above her left breast, and one on her left bicep. Photos of these bruises are presented to the jurors. Only a couple of them are shown publicly to the courtroom. Others are kept private, only for the jury and the counsel. There are multiple bruises pictured up and down Tammy's arms. Dr. Christensen says these bruises occurred before Tammy died, but right around the time she died. He also said he saw fixed lividity on Tammy Daybell's back. This is when the blood pools and then becomes immovable. Dr. Christensen testifies that based on Tammy being cold and stiff at 6 a.m., it's likely she died hours earlier. He goes on to say that he looked into other causes of death, and he is certain Tammy Daybell's cause of death was asphyxia, and her manner of death was homicide. With that, Lindsay Blake has no further questions. The defense will wait to cross-examine Dr. Christensen until the following morning, on Tuesday, May 2nd, 2023. John Thomas starts Tuesday morning off with the cross-examination of Dr. Eric Christensen. He wants to go into depth about the doctor's education and background in the work he's doing. John asks if that frothy substance in Tammy's throat was tested, but Dr. Christensen says he's not aware of any tests for that. John asks about the possibility that Tammy died of a seizure. Dr. Christensen said that this would be the only other possibility, but it would have been highly unlikely given her medical history. John asks about a medication Tammy was on, a version of Prozac. It had a side effect of seizures. The doctor replies that it probably does. He's not aware of all the side effects of every single drug, but he makes it clear he does not believe that Tammy died of a seizure. John asks if the doctor tested for vitamin poisoning from taking too many vitamins. The doctor says he didn't. So then John asks if he tested for essential oil poisoning. But Dr. Christensen has never heard of a test like that. John asks if the bruises could have been caused by a fall instead of being restrained. Dr. Christensen says he can't say 100% what caused the bruising, but it is consistent with restraint. On a redirect questioning conducted by Lindsay Blake, she asks if a dead person could roll out of bed. He replies, quote, "not without some external force applied." He does note that he has seen a dead body move or shift because of decomposition changes, but this does not happen in a very recent death, one within hours. He again reiterates that he determined the cause of death was asphyxia. Dr. Eric Christensen is now released from his subpoena and led out of the courtroom. Detective Bruce Mattingly is brought back to the stand by prosecutor Lindsay Blake. Remember, he is a detective with the Fremont County Sheriff's Office. He testifies that no other detective responds to the scene of Tammy Daybell's death. He knows Officer Allie Greenhall, the deputy coroner, and the coroner all did respond. In November, the Fremont County Sheriff's Office became involved in the investigation of the missing children. In December, Tammy's death is now being investigated. Detective Mattingly served search warrants for medical and pharmacy records in the investigation of Tammy Daybell's death. There was no indication that Tammy had suffered from fainting, seizures, or low blood pressure. The investigators were also able to identify a Fitbit account that belonged to Tammy Daybell. These records indicated that Tammy was above average and healthy. There was no slowdown in her activity in the months leading up to her death. Detectives also interviewed family and friends who indicated that Tammy was healthy and active in multiple fitness classes, as well as training for a 5K. Detective Mattingly testifies that Tammy had two life insurance policies. One was through Primerica, and the other was through LifeMap. Search warrants were sent to both companies, who provided Detective Mattingly with response documents. Both Chad and Tammy were listed on the policy as both insured and both beneficiaries. Tammy's life insurance through Primerica paid out $300,000 to Chad Daybell. $80,000 from LifeMap was also paid out to Chad Daybell. There was an additional $50,000 with this life insurance policy as well, so it totaled $130,000. The $50,000 seems to be a retirement-type payout for later on. Lindsay Blake has no further questions. Jim Archibald conducts the cross-examination and asks if it's correct that Lori Vallow's device was not on the property of Chad Daybell on October 9th or on October 19th, 2019. Detective Mattingly testifies that this is correct. Then he goes on to ask the detective about the medication Tammy was prescribed. Detective Mattingly testified that Tammy had been prescribed an antidepressant. According to Tammy's Fitbit, it appears Tammy was taking about 5,000 steps a day. In August of 2019, Tammy looks to have a high month, so Jim asks if this is when she ran the 5K. Detective Mattingly is not sure. The detective testifies that the Primerica life insurance policy was established in Springville, Utah, before Chad and Tammy ever moved up to Idaho. The LifeMap policy was offered through the school. Jim asks if the life insurance companies took any action to get their money back from Chad Daybell, citing fraud. Detective Mattingly says he is not aware of any action taken, and the defense has no further questions. Lindsay Blake asks some follow-up questions. She wonders if Detective Mattingly could determine that Chad Daybell was living off the life insurance funds with Lori Vallow in Hawaii. The detective testifies that Chad was. With that, Detective Bruce Mattingly is officially released from his subpoena and excused from the witness stand. This podcast was produced by True Crime Exposed and is hosted by me, Kayla Waters. Please leave us a 5-star written review as we are a new podcast and help spread the word.